I would prefer if you addressed me as His Honor the High Sheriff of Nottingham.
We will no longer share in this pointless fantasy of yours.
Fine. Stay here and do nothing. By midday tomorrow, your crew will be safely aboard their ship. Of course, you will have to accept the consequences of your inaction.
Consequences?
What is the one thing that Robin Hood is most famous for?
He robs from the rich and gives to the poor.
Besides that...
It's Britney, bitch.
And Iraq, everywhere like such
a... I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie!
Our next-door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Yeah. When we started watching House of Dragon for our podcast, I was like, I'm mad at this already because I'm so deeply wounded by how Game of Thrones ended and how much it sucked for like the last three seasons.
Yes.
And I was like, this is boring for three episodes. And then I was like, okay, now you have my attention, like suddenly at one point in time. And I was like, I'm hooked again and I love it.
Yes, that's so true. I watched it the same way where I was like, entertain me, just try after you betrayed me so hard.
Oof. No one will ever get me again. You can never break my heart as much. It's like, you know, after your first great heartbreak, it'll never be that bad again because you'll always kind of hold something back. That's me in Game of Thrones. Like, nothing else can hurt me as badly. So,
I read The Fire and Blood, the fake Herodotus that George R. R. Martin wrote for his universe. And I finished it, and I was like, it's only half of the Targaryen reign. This is unfinished. Yeah. The bastard, he did it again. He can't keep getting away with it.
This motherfucker just needs to learn to write. Yeah. You know, I'm so angry as someone who's often forced to write for money, where I'm like, how am I writing more than this man? Yeah. Like, no one wants what I've got. Everybody wants what he's got, and he's like, nah.
I don't know, man. George is funny to me. I like him a lot. I love his writing. Mm-hmm. His fantasy writing is like perfect for me because he's just like, look, you don't need this backstory, but you're going to get it. And here are 60 characters. And you're going to, for some reason, love the one named like Big Testicle John. Why do you love Big Testicle John? Who fucking knows? Like, but he gets that. Very few people get that, like him and George Lucas. Make up some weird fucking guys, give them kooky character traits or looks or something, and just let it go. And people are like, oh man, I fucking love Salacious Crumb, the little rat thing. And I love I love Big Ben Plum. Like, oh, my favorite characters. And they just have, you know, Wikipedia pages that are as long as like George Washington's or something. Like, yeah, well, there you go, man. Yeah.
I like it. I think that in many ways, one of the things that I like about it too is I think that George R. R. Martin is kind of like a logical inheritor to Tolkien. I'm not saying that it's great literature, which I would defend Tolkien as.
Yeah.
But it's world building, and I fundamentally am a bit more interested in world building than anything else because I'm just a fucking nerd. Like what are you going to do? Yeah. Like, there's nothing you can do about it. I'm just all like, oh, okay, yeah, and then that's that family. Uh-huh, what's their sigil? Uh-huh, oh, word. Their granddad did what? Oh, you know, like, that's what I like, you know, so hey.
Yeah, and he's brilliant at giving you slightly more of the world building as the books go along. Like, every paperback volume of A Song of Ice and Fire features a new map of a new area. It's like, ooh, Slaver's Bay, that's new.
Yeah, and you're like, ooh, yeah. I'm mad for a map, me. Yeah. Like, show me a map, and it's just, yeah, it's over.
I have a theory that like, American fantasy writers are much more obsessed with economics. And so if you look at something like Dune or Game of Thrones, they have a very good idea of how the economy of these societies should work. Whereas if you compare that to like Lord of the Rings
Harry Potter, everybody's just an economy.
Yeah, everybody's like just pro bono. Like there is no economy.
The Shire is a self-sufficient anarcho-primitivist commune. It's quite clear.
Yeah.
Except you have quasi-indentured servants who are like gardeners.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because Sam is Frodo's gardener. Frodo is a quasi-noble.
Yeah, because Tolkien, because he's English, he can't imagine a world without the class system.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
He can imagine one without the economy, but not the class system.
He built an anarchist commune and then stuck a caste system in. Like, nope. It can't work. It can't work. attention.
It's very English. It's very English. Yeah. Fucking, I mean, and so did fucking J.K. Rowling, for that matter. She was like, oh, no, but they're, I mean, they're slaves.
Yeah.
Like, don't worry about
clear.
That. And they love it. They fucking love it.
They love it.
Yeah, one of the worst J.K. Rowling tweets, and there's a lot of them, was when she was like, you know, I never said Hermione wasn't black. Oh, and I said she had frizzy hair or whatever.
So maybe I was just being racist.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, so it's like, so let's reread all those passages where Hermione is agitating for the house elves and everyone's like, again with this. Oh my gosh, it's so annoying. Mm-hmm. That makes it a million times worse.
She's such an insane turf. Everyone on this island has like BSE, and that's basically why everyone's very angry at trans people. Like, everything's on fire. Mm-hmm. We're about to drown under like the water and nobody cares. It's but you know, everyone is like, I feel like the trans have done this, and it's
no,
and it's because they have BSE. That's why they all ate some bad burgers in the 80s, and this is how you get this society, basically.
Okay, shall we get at it?
Yes.
Yeah, we should, actually. Yeah. Sorry. Yes. Stop having fun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ben, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Giordano.
Hello, hello.
Welcome to Remember Shuffle, and today we are joined by Luke Waters and Dr. Eleanor Janega, the hosts of the We're Not So Different podcast, to discuss 2010's Robin Hood. Say hi, y'all.
Hello.
Hi.
This movie's bad. I'm so excited.
Yes. Okay, good. I'm glad you agree, because we wrote this outline where we're like, they have to think that this is a bad movie, right?
Oh, God, yes. Like, I really love that about it. You know, that's the only thing to love about it. But anyway.
The worst thing is that I not only had to think about its badness from the perspective of it just being a bad movie, but because I've learned so much from Eleanor, I had to be like, wait, that doesn't make any goddamn sense. So I had to know the pain from another perspective.
Yeah, see, if you don't know a lot about history, you're just like, oh, this movie's convoluted and boring. But if you do know a lot about history, you're like, this is convoluted and boring and a slap in the face to history.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, we brought them on as subject matter experts since they run a medieval history podcast that also does movie reviews, so you should give them a follow.
Yes, check it out. They have some excellent reviews of The Northman and A Knight's Tale, a 2000s movie.
Two good movies.
Yes.
They're going to put Mark Addy to much worse use here, and that just makes me sad.
And Tom Wamsgams is done dirty in this movie as well.
Oh, yeah. So dirty. Yeah.
Doesn't have a lot to do. Yeah. And we gave you the option of three different movies, Robin Hood, King Arthur, and Kingdom of Heaven. And I'm so glad that you chose this one, because there's just so much in this movie that's wrong. It's fascinating how wrong this movie is on almost every level.
I think the one thing we missed here is that you might have seen me and Eleanor really disagree if we'd done The Kingdom of Heaven and we'd done the extended cut. Mm. Because the movie, the history in the movie is garbage. Yeah. Obviously, just putting that out there. But I have a deep love for that terrible, weirdly paced, fucked up movie.
I was hoping that this was a movie that would have been bailed out by the director's cut, like another Ridley Scott movie, that if you just added 20 minutes, it makes sense. But sadly, it's not the case.
No.
So yeah, what made y'all choose this one?
Okay, so one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk about this one is because it's like a gotcha. It kind of like reels you in. It's kind of like a rope-a-dope thing, because it starts off and I'm like, oh, word. We're going to talk about how Richard Lionheart is a fucking piece of shit. I love that. Mm-hmm. That's like one of my favorite, you know, historical facts. I hate that guy. And I was like, yes, like, come on, demystify, you know, the legend of Richard the Lionheart. And he wasn't going to save anyone. And yes, like, war is messy and this is what it's like. And then you just fall off this cliff and it turns into this completely ahistorical nonsense about how, like, I don't know, kings really wanted a peasant anarcho society, actually. and like the English naturally tend towards that question mark, and are only like being brought down by the French. It's so confusing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, I saw this movie when it came out. I didn't remember a goddamn thing about it at all.
Nice.
I didn't remember. Like, I remember everybody making fun of Russell Crowe's accent and, you know, everything.
Oh, yeah, that's bad.
And so I rented it and I watched it. But halfway through, I had to take my kid to a birthday party. And it was a, and I promise this is going somewhere. It was a birthday party where we were watching one of her friend's favorite movies. And that is Sonic the Hedgehog 2. That's the like real Sonic the Hedgehog with James Marsden and all that.
Yeah.
And let me just say, listeners, that Sonic the Hedgehog 2 is a much, much, much better movie than Robin Hood on every level. On every level. Like, even the bad CGI in Sonic the Hedgehog is better than the bad CGI here. So, yeah, that's my review of this movie in a nutshell. I rewatched it, and it was overshadowed by Jim Carrey talking to a CGI blue hair doll.
I like how they also just were like, yeah, this movie about English people, we're going to need some Australians now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get those Australians in here. Which is incredible, because as I always say about Australians, is they're kind of like British people 30 years ago in very many ways, right? And also, like, this is no shade on Cate Blanchett. She can do anything she wants. Yeah. She can just take my money. And I'm like, great job, babe. Love to see you.
They're like British people 30 years ago, and the Australians still really love coal.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's like, it's all coal and pies, baby.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's going on over there. Yeah.
So yeah, we wanted to talk about this one because I think there's a lot of trends and forces of 2000s pop culture that are represented by this film. And I think the biggest one is that this is your gritty, realistic, grounded, quote unquote, historical epic that just thrived in the decade.
Mm.
The two most famous ones are really, you know, Batman Begins and Casino Royale, which aren't period pieces, but these really open the floodgates for it's going to be grounded, it's going to be realistic, it's not going to be fun, it's not going to be silly. It's going to be about how James Bond has trauma. It's going to be about how Batman has trauma. And yeah, you're not coming to the movies for fun anymore. And this trickles into the historical epics at the time as well.
Mm.
And you know what? The gritty, grounded thing, it works when the source material can also be gritty and grounded. But Ridley Scott decided to make a gritty reboot of a romantic folktale about merry men. And all of the shenanigans that I wanted to see were replaced with bad ahistorical feudalism.
I don't know how you do it. Like, I mean, draining the life out of let's steal from the rich.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
A time-honored and much-loved tradition. How is this not a romp?
Yes.
You know, if there's no romping at the revolution, I'm not coming, etc. Yeah. You know, like, that's all.
And that's my biggest issue with the movie is, like, what's the one-sentence summary of Robin Hood? He steals from the rich and he gives to the poor. Just that's a very simple elevator pitch for Robin Hood, which he just doesn't do in this movie. And instead, this movie posits like a sort of trickle-down liberty concept where Robin Hood has to make incrementalist reformist changes from the inside and help the barons pass the Magna Carta.
Fucking barons. Literal barons.
Oh, who, you know, they just, the barons just really have the best interests of the common people at heart. That's what's going on there.
Yeah.
That's all that was happening. It was definitely not about fishing weirs. I want to make that clear.
We kept referring to him as neoliberal Robin Hood because it's like, do you want to hunt in the King's Forest or would you like the child tax credit for every child? Like, this is his approach to stealing from the rich and giving to the poor is like doing it. I want to do it at scale. I'm not trying to rob a single caravan. I'm trying to pass legislation like the Magna Carta, which, as we all know, is meant to help the peasantry.
He's like, we need to means test access to the Baron's Forest. And if you make less than this, then you may poach. And otherwise, no. Yeah, which it's the most aughts thing that you could possibly be. You know, here we are at the end of history. We all agree it has to be neoliberalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading some IMDb trivia. Ridley Scott said his favorite Robin Hood movie and the only one he liked was Robin Hood Men in Tights. And I cannot understand how you watch that movie and then do something and take all the fun. I saw very few, if any, men in tight.
Yeah.
Yeah, where's the tights?
He doesn't put on the Lincoln green until the last scene of the movie.
Yeah.
It's which is ironically ahistorical, but it goes into that whole grit, like, you know, the thing that's quite funny about this desire for gritty realism, quote unquote, within movies of that time is it's historically inaccurate. Like, you know, every single one of these idiots would be like in bright yellow, right? Because that's just what medieval people like. Medieval people are like, I feel like it needs to be six colors or no one's going to take me seriously. You know,
Actually, what are your favorite Robin Hood adaptations?
Oh, I mean, I have a huge soft spot for Prince of Thieves.
Okay.
Mostly because, oh my God, why can't I remember his name?
Oh, Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman, who yes. can, who could get it? I want to make that abundantly clear. Yeah. R.I.P. Yep. to a real one.
Yeah.
But I love Alan Rickman. Like, nothing else about that is important. But, you know, the 90s desire to do historical realism by being like, there were black people in England, you know, blowing your mind. Yeah. And it's like, well, that's true. Okay, well done. That one's really good. But also, I've got to shout out the Disney one with the foxes yes. when I was a kid. Yes. Huge for me. Again, Fox Robin Hood could get it. Yeah. It's very confusing.
You heard it here first, folks.
The start of so many furries. Of so, yeah, many, like, so many furries.
Luckily, it didn't go that way for me. But
yeah. Dodging a bullet.
This is one of the things that's super confusing about this particular iteration of Robin Hood is there's like no one who can get it in this movie other than possibly Cate Blanchett, where you're like, like they've also de-sexed the situation. Like 100%. Most unsexily,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Which is confounding, frankly.
Yeah.
So
in preparation, we watched the 1938 one.
Oh, that's a good one.
The 1938 one is fun. It has the appropriate amount of shenanigans.
Yeah, and a clear understanding of the class politics, or at least a clearer understanding than,
or at least one that makes sense in the film.
Yeah,
there are effete Normans on top, and the good blood of the earth Saxons on the bottom.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the cartoon we rewatched as well, and I was surprised to see that that cartoon is where the hamster dance came from. That song is from the cartoon, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Jeez.
They sped it up and remixed it.
Yeah.
Wild.
Jesus. Okay. Well, yeah. It's all coming together in my elder millennial mind at this point. Yeah. But yeah.
Mm. Luke, how about you? You got a favorite Robin Hood?
Man, Men in Tights is great.
It rocks.
I love Men in Tights.
Can't go wrong.
Carrie Ewells. I love the whole thing. Fantastic.
I love that slapstick can never die. The context to slapstick, it never changes. It's the only type of comedy that is truly timeless.
And Mel Brooks is great for like a combination of slapstick and groan-inducing puns and wordplay and visual gags. It's just, it's perfect.
Did you say Abe Lincoln? No, I said Abe Lincoln.
That's my favorite line.
Single time I hear Abraham Lincoln's name, I think it. Every time. It does not matter. It doesn't matter the context. It does not matter what's going on. I think Abe Lincoln every time. The Emancipator. The only decent president America's ever had. And he's forever connected to Mel Brooks. Just terrible, terrible, amazing pun.
But this is the thing, right? So we can rattle off all these amazing Robin Hoods, right? But this is the bad one.
Yes.
Right? Because even if you're like, well, Prince of Thieves, it is so cheesy and like early 90s, so it's not really for me. Everyone will go, yeah, give you that. But you can be like, but it's a bit of fun though, isn't it? Bit of fun, right? Like all of them are fun, except this one where Ridley Scott was like, how do we make it suck?
Yeah.
Right? How do we spend like $200 million and make it suck?
Right? And it's not like my man Rusty can't do historical drama. We all know that the oceans are now battlefields, etc. Right? Like we know that my man can eat it up,
yes,
but not when the source material is this whack.
Yeah, we rewatched the trailer for this movie after we had prepped the whole thing, and the trailer is like, see the truth behind the legend. It's like, fuck the truth. Give me the legend.
I don't want it. And it's like, and also, it's like, this is the truth. The truth is that barons are real good guys. That's your truth. Actually, don't be too mad at rich people, everyone. It's just the wrong kind of rich person, which is to say the French.
Yeah. Yes.
The secret Magna Carta that we had buried there for, you know, for years.
And here's what pisses me off. And we're about to get to our plot summary, listener, because you probably neither saw nor remember this film. But they don't even pass the Magna Carta. They do a 2.5-hour bait and switch. Where it's like, oh, we have conflict, we have friction between the nobles and the king, but at the last minute, that wicked King John isn't going to sign it. So Robin Hood has a quest for the sequel.
And what would that be like? You know, Robin Hood 2 Magna 2 Carta? Like, what?
Yes.
What is it that you like? You're saying that I want to like watch more of the bureaucracy. Like, what's he going to do? Go lobby parliament that doesn't exist yet? Or like, oh, he's going to be like, I'm setting it up and this will really free. Like, no, get out of here. Get out of here. Like,
yeah, it sucks. The one good thing you can say about this movie, and we'll do this in full in our reception echoes in the culture section, but the 2000s had a million sword and sandals movies, a bit of a renaissance for the genre. Gladiator, Knight's Tale, Troy, Alexander, King Arthur, 300, Kingdom of Heaven, running the gamut in quality. But this movie was such a big flop that I think a lot of people point to it as what kind of, I mean, it didn't kill the genre, they're still making them, but there's a lot fewer of them than there used to be.
So yeah, let's get into our plot summary. And this is very difficult to do because the plot is not simple or succinct. So you might assume that a movie called Robin Hood is about a Robin Hood stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, engaging in shenanigans with his merry men, vanquishing the wicked Sheriff of Nottingham. But you would be wrong. There are three storylines in this movie, and none of them involve Robin Hood stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. It's a superhero origin story, but for Robin Hood. So he's coming back from the Crusades, and he comes upon a dying Sir Robert Locksley and takes up his identity. And he lives with Robert Locksley's family to avoid their lands being seized by the king, who has raised taxes to pay for the king's ransom. So Maid Marian in this movie is the wife of the man whose identity he has assumed.
Yeah, it's weird.
So she's not a maid. I just want to make it incredibly clear how much not a maid she is, but all right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just like that the plot of most of this movie is just them gaslighting an entire town of people. They're like, no, this is him. And they're like, that... It's like the episode of The Simpsons, the Armin Tamzarian, you know, the fake Seymour Skinner, like, where his mom is like, yes, you must be my son, just so they don't have to talk about the awkwardness. It's like, yes, yes, this is it. Yes. Now go to your room, up the stairs, third door on the left.
Yeah. And that brings us to our second point, which is that Russell Crowe, Robin Hood, his father was known to this family that he's impersonating. So presumably he would have been known in the village and his son would have grown up near there, because Robin Hood's deceased father was trying to pass the Magna Carta. He was a political advocate for the rights of barons.
Yes.
He's just a lawyer, you know.
The greatest Englishman to ever live,
basically. Yes, this whole thing is instigated because Robin Hood sees just an absolute platitude inscribed on the hilt of a sword. Rise, rise, rise until lions become lambs. And he says, I've heard that before. And it was his father's creed as he agitated for the Magna Carta.
Mm-hmm.
So plot line number two, as we said, is Magna Carta : the movie.
Yeah.
And then finally, the third plot line is what I like to call Saving Private Robin. Because the French invade England. At the beginning of the movie, Richard the Lionheart is killed, and there's a conspiracy involving bringing the French into England to take advantage of the weak King John for the French to take over England. And they literally do a reverse D-Day, complete with the rectangular landing boats in a medieval times, in which now England is invaded by the godless continental Europeans.
I have such a lot of news for you about who the Plantagenets are. Like, it's ruled by French people. Yeah. You get that, right? Yep. Like, they're French. John, French. Richard the Lionheart, French. Eleanor of Aquitaine, French. They are fucking French. And it's like they have the thing about John having the affair with, like, the hot French bitch or whatever, and they're like, no, see, she's really French. I'm like, they're all French! Yeah. That's the entire point of it. Like, the Norman invasion just happened 2 seconds ago. Mm-hmm. These people speak French. They do not speak English. Richard the Lionheart was in England like 4 times.
Yeah.
Question mark. Mm-hmm. They do not care. This is just a way of milking money and like for them to pretend they're fancier at French court than they are. No one is English. That is not what is happening right now. Like, for fuck's sake.
One of the big main things that people know about Eleanor of Aquitaine and Richard the Lionheart specifically is that both of them fucking didn't want to be in England. They didn't like it. They thought it was a backwater, hick sheepfold. And they were right.
And they were right.
They didn't want to be there until, like, I see this and I'm like, oh, Eleanor must be hating this. There's no way Eleanor of Aquitaine would deign to be here, let alone participate. participate in these charades.
Yeah. She was like, look, I'm running the joint. Yeah. I want to make it clear, but I'm mad about it, right? And she's just like, I've been, you know, you name it. Like she used to be the queen of France for, like literally, yeah, before she took up this gig. And I always feel so bad about her because it's a run of bad marriages. It's just like all these men were just like not up to the task, right? And then they do her like, oh, well, no, I'm just like this really, really deeply involved English woman. I'm like, how? Mm-hmm. How? The of Aquitaine, right there in the name, right? Like, I don't, like, it's not Eleanor of, like, a bloody Hurstmanso or something. Like, sorry, that was a deep cut. That was too British. Let me go. It's not Eleanor of, you know, Richmond. How about that?
Yeah.
We can go with that? Is that better? All right. Okay, yeah. Birmingham. I don't know.
Let's just talk about this section first, then, the Saving Private Robin section, because this movie presents a version of history in which Robin Hood does a Thermopylae on the beaches of Dover to protect English nationalism. And the existential idea of the English nation rests on Robin Hood's back. And, like, we could have lost English civilization on this day had Robin Hood not been competent enough.
Chad's would be a fine thing, I'll say that. But... yeah, this is what's so funny to me, too. It's just like, yeah, you know, that concept of nationhood that medieval people definitely had. And it's like, they don't have a word for it. Mm-hmm. They don't have a concept of it. You start getting the idea kind of in the later medieval period, like in the late 14th century and stuff like that. You have people kind of say it. But even then, like Czechs, who are the people I work on, the word they use is jazyk, which also means language or tongue. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like partially they're just like, yeah, we don't like Germans. What am I going to tell you? that's what they mean. They don't like people who are speaking German, right? They want people who are speaking Czech, and that's kind of their thing. And it's not even necessarily like about the culture being different. They're just like, shut up and speak Czech. That's kind of like their deal, right? Yeah. English people definitely don't have this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only been 5 seconds. Like, you know, what really united England into England has only been hanging out for like 5 seconds. It was like all Mercia and Wessex and Northumbria before then, right? It was like all these disparate kingdoms, which are really different in terms of the culture and things like that.
Bring them back. Bring back Northumbria.
Mate. Oh, I wish, dude. Yeah. Like, shout out to Northumberland, where I've been multiple times recently. Really beautiful part of the world. But in many ways, the Norman invasion is part of the thing that crystallized Englishness, actually, in a way, because suddenly you don't have the Danelaw anymore. Mm-hmm. And you don't have 12 kingdoms. It's like, no, it's just one thing. It's England. It's, oh, mm-hmm. I guess we're English. Mm-hmm. It's such an incredibly modern thing to foist on this period of the time. And it makes it so stupid, specifically within this Englishness, because you could say that a sense of English, you could like play this in a way saying, we'll get a sense of Englishness out of this? Question mark. Like, there's ways to make a nationalist statement if you wanted, but this is so hackneyed.
They want to do the Battle of Britain again, right?
Yeah.
I've never been to the UK, but from what I understand, the biggest thing in their national consciousness is that period before America enters the war, but after France has fallen, where they're in the tube eating beans, and they're like, this is the greatest single thing any nation has ever done, us single-handedly standing against fascism. Winston Churchill, number one, greatest Brit, what, Bengal? And that's like, that's
exactly that is the narrative. You have got it, baby. Like, that is exactly, this is the English malaise. Mm-hmm. And the thing that people here want is for everyone to suffer, right? Like, that's what's really important. Like, in Britain, there isn't this idea about, someone has more than me, and so maybe they should share. They're like, that person should be as miserable as I am. Mm-hmm. And then if someone is more miserable than you, you're like, well, good. Right? And then they like blame it on the Blitz, where they're like, which everyone loved. And it's like, no, they didn't. Your parents were profoundly traumatized. You know, no one is alive anymore who was even alive during World War II. Like, my grandma was in the Blitz. She's Irish, but she was here in the Blitz, and she would not speak about it, right? Mm-hmm. Because she just had such screaming PTSD from it.
Yeah.
It was not a nice time. No one was like down doing the fucking hokey cokey in the tube, right? It was all like, it was earth shattering and awful. But because their parents didn't hug them, they're like, because they were so prepared, they're like, no, that was great. So anyway, yes, exactly. And now they want to make movies about it. Yeah. Okay. Right. Like, that's what they want
to
do.
They need to project that back.
Mm-hmm. You got to keep doing that.
Yeah. Anachronism doesn't necessarily ruin a film, but it does if this is what you're trying to get out of it. If you're just trying to, like, relive that high of this time that was actually terrible and traumatic and ruined the place.
The problem with doing the, like, this is the real version of this medieval telling is that a lot of the stuff that we know from the Middle Ages in these stories, they have mythical and fictional elements imbued into them, or they're just fictional stories that have become kind of nationalized myths, like your King Arthur or in Robin Hood and stuff like that. And when you're like, oh, this is the real Robin Hood,
mm-hmm.
you're going to try and ground something in reality. But the fanciful nature of it and the over-the-top way the story is told in the first place is the reason that everybody remembers it. If the original story is like this guy secretly helped write the Magna Carta, nobody, no kids want to hear that story because it's boring. And kids don't like that. And when most people go see action movies, they don't want to see that shit either. I don't want to see the real retelling of an ancient story, stories from like Sumer or something, like the grounded telling of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Ugh.
Yeah, of course, they probably got the flood myth from like a big flood that happened in the area. And we know that. And it's interesting to see what historians have to say about that and what archaeologists do. But at the same time, you want to hear the Epic of Gilgamesh because you want to hear him save the world with his buddy. We're not here for like, oh, it was actually the 4.2 kill a year event. It's like, no, that's not an action movie. I'm here for action. This is boring.
Local counselors got together and there was a meeting where they raised revenues 0.25% per household in order to build a dam to stop flooding. Like, that's the equivalent, right? Yeah.
And this is an excellent transition to our other point, which is this story as like a superhero origin story, which is that why do a realistic version of a folk tale?
Yes.
The genre of a folk tale is not, it's like doing a Santa Claus gritty origin story. Why bother taking something?
Get Detective Crashmore. That's an I think you should leave reference. Sorry. It looks like I'm not coming with you anyway. All right.
I was thinking of that bloody R-rated campy Santa movie that came out recently. Yeah, I think there's a way you can do that, but you have to like embrace like the goofiness of it, and there's no embracing of goofiness here. There's no apples. Where's the apple? Nobody got an apple shot off their head.
That's the thing, right? It's gone so far. It's so terrified that it might become camp that it doesn't have any fun at all whatsoever. There's this like, oh no, we must be serious. And it's like, but why?
Yeah.
Why? No one was ever like, man, thing that I hate about Robin Hood is how fun it is. I really hope no one helps any poor people.
Like, that was my least favorite part of every Robin Hood movie is when he gave money to the poor people and he stole from the rich.
Yep. To echo what Luke was saying, from what I understand, and I'm no expert here, there were myths around even like Richard the Lionheart. 10 years ago, I read like an airport dad popular history book called The Troubadour Song that was about the capture and ransom of Richard the Lionheart. And it was filled with these wacky stories like Richard the Lionheart ripping the heart out of a lion in the period, or like the story of the bard Blondel, who would walk around the valleys of the Rhine singing the song that only Richard the Lionheart knew the part to, so that when he sang back, he could find the castle of Dürnstein where he was or whatever. It's like, yo, give me that. Give me that shit. Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And there's a way to do a gritty thing about how, like, actually Richard the Lionheart sucks, too. You could have that in and then be like, yeah, and see, he doesn't actually care about regular people.
Mm-hmm.
No one is coming to save you. So, therefore, you need the local superhero because you can't depend on royalty to help you, right? Like, that would be a really obvious way to do it. No.
Yep.
No.
You could, I mean, you could theoretically do a good, gritty Robin Hood, but you would have to go so all in on the message and over the top on the gore and everything like that. It's something that they didn't really want to do here. And like Eleanor said, you would have to make it so over the top that it was approaching camp. And Ridley Scott was not having any of that here, if he has ever had any of that in his life. But yeah, you just pull all the life out of it and then you're like, it's a gritty retelling. And we're like, I guess, man. The Dark Knight is a good Batman story because you can tell that story well. And it's a pretty dang good superhero movie. But there's also goofy Batman and 60s Batman and new emo Bat. Like, you know, you just...
If the character works like that, it can work if you tell a good story. And Robin Hood, I think, could work like this because it is a fun character, but not with this shit.
Yeah. And I got gripes with the concept of the origin story as a compelling narrative. Mm-hmm. In the 2000s, we literally had a movie called X-Men Origins : Wolverine. And there was almost an X-Men Origins : Magneto. They were going to do a whole extended universe of origin stories.
Can you imagine how tone deaf and bad and awful that an Origins Magneto movie would be? Because it would inevitably be set in a Nazi internment camp. Sorry. Yeah,
and my beef is that everyone whose butts are in the seats knows who these people are, probably. Mm. And the interesting part of the story is them doing the thing, right? If you watch 1989 Batman, he is already Batman in the first scene.
Yeah.
And they tell the origin in flashbacks or whatever. But it's just a way to really cynically turn something into a franchise and a cash cow. Like, I describe it as an origin movie is, imagine if Ocean's 11 was just the I'm assembling a crew part of the movie and you didn't get the heist at the end. The good origin stories, like Batman Begins, give you at least half the movie when, like, okay, the origins have been established, we're doing the thing. This fucking movie, this Robin Hood movie, it's the very final, final scene. We have him shoot an arrow as the Sheriff of Nottingham is looking for a nail and a hammer to pin up the thing that is declaring him an outlaw. They give us the smallest taste at the final scene after 2.5 hours.
There's like no archery. There's like no archery. and it makes me so mad because I love archery. No. Okay, so the thing that I'm kind of thinking is that one of the reasons why Batman Begins works as a prequel too is that Ridley Scott is kind of like channeling like Alan Moore Batman, right? So we have material, good source material for you to like turn into a movie in order to do that. There is no gritty retelling of Robin Hood story because that's stupid and it sucks. So it's like, you know that it's not going to happen, right? So if Alan Moore had written a gritty Robin Hood, I'd be like, that's compelling. Yeah. I would like to see that. Alan, get on it. You're not going to. You're too busy not finishing several other comic projects. That's fine. Little joke there about America's best comics, everybody. Anyway, it's one of these things where it doesn't exist because it's bad, right? Mm-hmm. And Ridley Scott, for whatever it is that he is good at, it's not like an auteur from the ground up, right? Mm-hmm. He's a good interpreter.
Comparing it to how movies have gotten a lot worse overall and have gotten more into the like, okay, we're going to try and set up this franchise thing. I was reading, and I think it was on Twitter, someone was talking about how, you know, the origin stories suck. And one of the quotes of it said, like, with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you learn about where Indy got the scar, where he got his whip, where he got the hat and everything. And you learn about it in the first 10 to 15 minutes of the movie. And the thing about it is the reason that nobody goes, oh, I hated it because you got to see where Indy got his whip or something like that is because it just treats it like we're doing this fast. You need to know. It treats the character with like a certain amount of reverence. It treats it with the same pastiche and overall jokiness and humor that the rest of it does. And it shows this and it doesn't linger on it. It's there so you can see how Indy got like this, his fucked up relationship with his dad. And then we're going to the real thing that we all want, which is Harrison Ford and Sean Connery cutting up and punching Nazis. And like, now that would be its own movie. Like it would be Solo. Yes. And I'm not here to talk about Solo. And I'm sorry, I'm referencing Star Wars, but those are the difference. And you can see how movies have gotten worse. And this is a classic example. It's like, how did Robin Hood get his green jacket and bow? It's like, well, we don't know, but here's how he kind of signed the Magna Carta. And you're just like, why is this 6 movies? Why is this 6 or 7 movies? Why are you doing this?
Why don't you do like the one where he starts doing cool shit, and then if that goes down well, you can make this gritty prequel. Yeah. How about that, Ridley? Yeah. Can I get the good one? Come on, man.
Apparently, this 85-year-old man is working on a Gladiator 2.
Ooh, no.
Be with your family. Ooh, like,
man, that's going to be a movie, huh? I don't, you know what, saying that, and they could get someone in there. If he's just exec producing it, I'm sure you could probably get someone in there who could do a really good job with it. But Kim doing the whole thing, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Yeah. There's an alternate universe where Ridley Scott stuck to sci-fi, right? This is the man who gave us Alien and Blade Runner. My God, man, what might
and
have
if he
been?
Just done those two things, we would be like, that's perfect. And I'm here talking about Robin Hood brackets 2010. It's just oof. Yeah. But you can also understand why I thought I might like it, right? Given that pedigree and given, you know, Kate and Rusty and et cetera, right?
Also, can I just say that I don't think Russell Crowe's accent is that bad. It's not good. Please let me be clear. It's not good. But compared to all the lead into it and like how much of a thing, I mean, it slips in and out and he's pulling from a bunch of different things, but I've heard way, way worse.
We watched this right after watching the Tomb Raider movie and we're like, I think it's better than Angelina Jolie's accent or Daniel Craig's American accent.
I think the difference is that here you have Russell Crowe attempting a regional British accent, which are, you know, notoriously difficult, right? Well, I mean, for us, all of my English friends could just like pull one out of their bag right now, but I can't. But they can't do American accents, so that's fine. But he was attempting to kind of do Northern, more specifically, which is kind of like, I guess maybe Nottingham's the north. You got to understand, my boyfriend's from Derby, which is like down the road from Nottingham. And they are like not northern to capital N's, right? They're the Northeast Midlands, God damn it, right? And then he's got this very particular accent. And anyway, my point is it's not a Nottingham accent or like whatever the fuck. And it's certainly not Yorkshire. And if you wanted that, go get your man Sean Bean. Mm. He'll do Yorkshire all day long. Yeah, that's all my man Sean can do is Yorkshire, right? Yeah. Whereas... when Angelina Jolie is attempting what we call RP or received pronunciation, which is to say BBC English, it's like, but also it's nobody's accent, so nobody gets offended.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, true. I guess that does make more sense why British people specifically, because like, dog, there's a lot of really bad British accents out there.
Oh, word. Like, I mean, I'm absolutely obsessed with British people trying to do American accents because they can't say R's. It's great.
Yeah, it's good.
It's very good. Yeah.
Just before we move on to the bit about the Magna Carta here, I wanted to ask, we don't even know that Robin Hood was a real person, right? I wanted to ask about like any sources that we have on Robin Hood.
It's something that like goes back and forth. It's mostly just a folktale.
Yeah.
It's basically it. You know, like, yeah, occasionally people would rob rich people because that's cool and fun. And also traveling, notoriously very dangerous in the Middle Ages. You know, you would just get jacked all the time. So there's kind of that. But like, yeah, not really. Yeah. Not really. It's mostly like just folk stuff.
I've heard that it's almost like a Dickensian naming. It's like the John Doe equivalent for law enfortment. They would write like, oh, he was a Robin Hood. That's like their John Doe or something.
Exactly. This entire thing is just kind of like a pastiche. It's like a bunch of people kind of put together and then, you know, and a form of wish fulfillment. You know,
it's a cope,
and
right? It's a big cope.
It's a complete cope. Yeah. Like someday someone is going to come and stick it to the man and that would be great. And I think that it's actually in many ways so insulting to take it from that and turn it into like this whole Magna Carta wank fest when Magna Carta doesn't do a goddamn thing for regular people.
You keep anticipating the questions we have for you.
Sorry. I'm just so angry. because Magna Carta is wank and the weird stories that people tell about it now, like actually do real world damage.
Yeah. Why do we all, like, I learned about the Magna Carta in my Canadian high school civics class. And then recently I heard like, oh yeah, this did nothing. This like,
allow me to briefly explain because I've
Luke
learned something.
It, yeah.
It's because the founding fathers were obsessed with it.
Yeah. It's like us trying to project a Declaration of Independence on them. Right.
Essentially the way it's taught to us, as Eleanor's told me again, I'm not actually a historian. I'm just along for the ride.
No, but that's exactly right. Is that the founding fathers were looking for a myth, right? And they were like, oh, Magna Carta grants you all these rights. And I'm kind of like, in the way that the founding father actually intended it, sort of, yeah, they're like, says here, rich people can do whatever they want, fuck you, right? Like, that's what Magna Carta says, right? And also people kind of like get Magna Carta wrong, just sort of generally because of what that legend is. Magna Carta isn't actually about, quote unquote, limiting the rights of the monarchy. It's more about reestablishing what were considered to be traditional rights of the nobility, which is what like all legal documents are at the time, right? It's just like rich people being like, no, that's my land, you can't have it. And it's kind of attempting to establish an equilibrium of saying like, yeah, no, sorry, we're not centralizing that much power under the king. Barons and other, you know, established nobles, are going to retain this much autonomy on their own pieces of land, and you've got to get out of our face. Also, this is how many fishing weirs I own. Fuck yeah, fishing weirs. Fishing weirs, fishing weirs, fishing... Like, there's just so much stuff about fishing weirs, right? Like, no one's ever talking about that.
What is a weir?
Yeah, it's like these things that you put out in the middle of rivers in order to kind of like bank up water and obstruct the flow. Okay. And it helps with fishing.
Cool.
Because like the fish has got like to go hang out next to them and stuff like that. So like there's absolutely tons of stuff about fishing weirs. And basically it's just like a document from a very specific time. And there's no such thing as a like right for regular people. You know, there are rights for like 25 guys. And none of this is on the books anymore. There's like three things that are on the books. One is about forests, a couple are about fishing weirs, and another is about the church. It doesn't do anything for regular people. And it got really sad. Like in COVID, there was kind of like our equivalent of sovereign citizens, where people were like, if you put Article 8 of Magna Carta, not a thing, up in your shop window, they can't make you close down because of COVID, and you can continue to run like your hairdressing place. And so all these people who are devastated because the government isn't giving enough money to help out when everybody's closing, they're like running these illegal hair cutting shops and then racking up huge fines because they believe some insane theory about Magna Carta. And it's really sad, right? And like fundamentally, we do not have a constitution in the United Kingdom. We don't have one.
Right, right.
Nope, there isn't one. There is a genre of law called constitutional law, but we don't have one. Magna Carta doesn't do anything for anyone except for 25 barons. And if you're not one of them, it's not going to do anything. It's just myth making. It's just another thing that the founding fathers have to answer for, right?
Damn.
It's really stupid, is the thing.
Ridley Scott putting an American myth into his Battle of Britain wish fulfillment. Good God, man.
Yeah. Yeah, because no, because England really invented America, you know. Yeah. That would be what we'd be like if we were given more room to genocide.
Okay, now let's, you know, maybe they're onto something there. That,
yeah, I know, right? Yeah. Learned it by watching you, etc. Right?
We did think that it was funny that the most class conscious line in the film comes from the Sheriff of Nottingham when he says that no one should own 4,000 acres.
Yeah. I know, and I was all like, base.
Yeah.
And I was like, I hate to agree with the Sheriff of Nottingham, yeah. But
the guy that
like,
we
that's
just
true.
Saw grope Maid Marian or non-Maid, yep. Lady yep. Marian.
Yeah, right? 100% he's right. I was like, my man is absolutely correct on this one. I was like, that's excellent, comrade. Like, redistribute it.
The only thing that they do that's even close to robbing from the rich and giving the poor is the grain thing. And that's the only time the movie's even kind of fun, because they hold up the coach that's going, and they steal the grain, and they are in hoods and everything like that, and then they go in the middle of the night and they sow the fields, and it's like, hey, that was fun, why don't we do more of that?
Like,
oh, there's right? a baron over here that's annoying some of, you know, and they have this thing with the kids in the forest, and it seems like Cate Blanchett is very upset that these kids are out there, and like she's trying to figure out a solution, and then the solution is just some of you can come help Robin Hood fight at this battle at the end of the movie.
Child soldiers is
yeah. He's doing his own children's crusade here. And then at the end, you can be our children in the forest commune that we have?
I mean, I'm all for the forest commune.
Yeah.
The minute I saw the forest commune, I'm like, oh, look, it's the bit I wanted to see.
Yeah. The movie that might have been good. As we wrap up our talk about these plot lines and move on to the reception, I love talking about the Crusades in 2000s medieval movies, right? At the time of the War on Terror. And I want to ask y'all, what is your thought on this ham-fisted metaphor that they love doing? This was, I think, the one almost joke in the film, is Robin Hood is asked by the king, what do you think of my wars? And he says, you know, I'm real bummed about all the war crimes we did. And the movie makes you think that he's a good and noble king, but instead it hard cuts to him in the stocks. It's almost a joke. It's one moment of almost levity. But yeah, how do you read us working through our feelings through the Crusades?
On the one hand, I don't think it necessarily hurts. On the other hand, I feel like one of the things that's managed to do now is like all it's done is emboldened these trads. 20 years later, the trads are like, yeah, and guess what? That's good. I like the way, which they were doing at the time anyway, right?
Yeah.
But it's a bit frustrating that everyone just kind of refuses to learn the great, talk about the war crimes and how it's bad and how people in positions of power don't want to hear. Sure. But also maybe, like, if you really wanted to make these points, one of the things you could be like, that would be also funny. You could be like, I think it's kind of far away and hard to continue to like requisition a bunch of soldiers in like a place where they're not wanted and maybe give up on that. You know, like that would have been a better message or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's more like, oh, ho hum. Like what? Like, it's just, I don't know. Like, how is that the thing we're playing for laughs? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, Ridley Scott's already done this and he did a better job with it in Kingdom of Heaven. And it's like,
oh, agreed.
In Kingdom of Heaven, at least, I mean, he gets ahistorical with it, but at least he questions why the Christians are all out there and why they treat everyone like shit and why all of these people are not all, but a lot of people saw Saladin as a much better choice than some shitty French noble or English noble or whatever it is. And, you know, he had the line Saladin does, you know, and Orlando Bloom is like, you know, how can I trust you? How do I know you're not going to pillage the place like so-and-so did back in the First Crusade? And, you know, and Saladin just turns around and goes, I am not those men, and then walks away. And it's like, yes, that, like, you can choose to be better. You can choose to be different. You know, Orlando Bloom chooses to lead his people out of there and get them away. Look, we're going to give up on this idea that we can hold part of the Holy Land and we can stop these people from controlling it. And Saladin is like, yes, I'm going to control it in a just way, you know, and again, ahistorical and all that stuff. But he's made that point and he's done the it's far away and war crimes are bad and colonialism is bad. But in this one, it was just rewritten too many times and everything got confused. And then even if it hadn't gotten confused, he's still like, yeah, as you guys said, it's just a mess. Yeah.
Also, it's one of the things, if you're really going to interrogate England's participation in the Crusades deeply, it was fairly limited because fundamentally, the only reason England was there was, again, they are Norman.
Yes.
They're Normans, right? And it was Norman. Sure, some Germans were there and stuff like that, but on the whole, it was led by Normans, and it was Normans who controlled Altamira and like all of these things. And it's like, England is there because they are French, not because they're England. Like, it,
yeah, yeah.
You know, the entire fucking thing is about Normanness. And, you know, the Norman Empire being what it is. And you see, there would have been an interesting way of interrogating that as well. But Ridley Scott's falling down on like, no, we're definitely English. Yeah. Like, so you can't do it. So you can't do the interesting thing, which would be a cool way to critique it. Also, about being like the kind of like coalition of English speakers who just shows up and fucks things up, you know, now. It's the same thing with like Normans, right? Would have been fun. Would have been interesting. Would have shown that, you know, this is something that changes. And it's not always the same group of people, but it is the same group of people in that it's rich assholes. That would have been useful, right? But no.
Yeah, it still blows my mind that George W. Bush called the war in Iraq a crusade. He just said the quiet part out loud back in the day. Like, wild
times. That man is so evil.
I was looking at news articles from that time, and Europeans were like, why would you call it a crusade? I think they understand that it was like a doomed failure. You don't want to call it that.
People here kind of know what the crusades are, which is like, you know, the first thing. And they're like, but that didn't go well. Okay.
None of the crusades, like, one of them ended up in sacking Constantinople and Christians sacking another Christian nation.
One of my favorite ones, the fuck you, pay me crusade.
And I mean, like, and they just called, like, we did a series on the crusades on the show, and a lot of the ones that you hear about, you know, the Northern Crusade or that Albigensian Crusade, stuff like that, sometimes it's just called a crusade because people hand it down through the ages and call it like that. And sometimes there's like a papal dispensation somewhere. And it's just like, they were land grabs. They were land grabs dressed up as religious intolerance, as like inquisitions. And it's just like, that's the same thing that was happening in Jerusalem. They just, the land grab was the Holy Land instead of Denmark or
Toulouse,
Slovenia,
or wherever. Slovenia, exactly, yeah.
A wild fact that blows my mind. There are some ancient texts that survived all the way to the 13th century and were lost in that Venetian sack of Constantinople.
Yep.
Yeah, the Venetians fucked it up. Like, we lost a bunch of stuff, which is one of the things that drives me crazy, too. Like, if people then wank off about, you know, the Renaissance being so great because we rediscovered all these old texts, I'm like, sometimes we'd already lost some text by that point because certain Venetians were getting a little out of pocket, right? It's just like, you know, the same people who you want to be like, oh, they've saved, like, oh, these Italians have saved culture. I'm like, well, sometimes they burn it, right?
You know what? I'll, like, I'll be generous and I'll call it a wash, you know? that's
yeah, exactly.
Something I've learned is the Library of Alexandria has been burned like 1,000 times.
Yes.
Constantinople was burned. Rome was burned. We're not, you know, big Roman statue fans on our show.
No, no.
When Rome burns, there's a lot of historic shit that burns with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And London burns, and Timbuktu, it was burned like 5 times, you know, and it's just like, and all of this stuff keeps happening. And so, like, you're absolutely right. And then, you know what happened when we went and did the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan? It all got burned again. And then the Taliban, who we spawned by our actions, did their own version of burning that stuff and burned stuff in Mosul and I think Tikrit everywhere. Yeah. Thank you. And the same, like, imperialist impulse that we had that led to the burning of Constantinople now leads to the burning of all the culture in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan, which was like the trade nexus of the world when the Silk Road was a big deal. Everything ran through there. That's the only place you can get lapis lazuli. Like, one of the most, like, beautiful and expensive jewels in the world. It's like, that's the only place it comes from. But we just fucking ground it into dust. Good job, George.
George, I hate him so much.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot on this pod about how fucking egregious it is that he's been so rehabilitated post-2016.
He's why I left America.
Word.
I was like, bitch, I'm out. I was like, I'm sorry. I was like, thanks, I'll be going, you know? And it is really offensive to me how he's been completely rehabilitated post-2016. Like, I want to make it clear, Trump's a monster. Sure. Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
That is not what I'm saying.
Of course.
But he didn't kill 3 million people?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just like, oh, you're just used to those 3 million people being dead now, are you? Well, I'm not.
Yeah.
And I think that it's worse. Hear me out. It's worse to kill 3 million people. That's just worse. And I know that we live in a world, you know, where war criminals are allowed to become 100 and walk around freely and things like this. But I don't think we should forget that because someone was kind of gauche once.
Yeah.
And it's just gross. You know, like, every time I see a picture of him palling around with the Obamas, I just lose it. Yeah. Like, I can't handle it, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So I would say that ends sort of the plot points about Robin Hood that we wanted to discuss. So I just wanted to bring up the style of this movie because I know you both love to talk about how medieval people weren't necessarily the miserable, dour people that we always portray them as being, and that they liked color. And this movie is not concerned with that. Like, the original Robin Hood from 1938, I think it's interesting that it was the first Technicolor film ever made. And they do a good job of showcasing the color of the what they imagined the medieval world look like. And in this movie, because it's a gritty reboot, it's just more about, like, showing you the different shades of gray and brown that existed in the era.
Yeah, it's so funny because it's, like, less historically accurate than, like, the ones from the 30s. Like, you know, actually, if you watch the ones from, like, the 60s and stuff like that, in terms of color palette, like, 60s, 70s, 50s, like, they're bang on. That's what you would expect to see. The actual dresses themselves and things that you see, not so much, but, you know, hey-ho. And, yeah, there's this desire for this reality that we've created about being, like, no one bathed, everything was brown, everyone was sleeping on, like, a mud floor, and it's just, like, not what was going on. And I think that it's such a waste, because the everyday beauty is the nice thing that you can talk about, and actually it humanizes. If this is really a story about humanizing the downtrodden and underclasses, then at least let my kids wear blue. They were all wearing blue, right? Like, you could make blue at home, you can make yellow at home, you can make green at home. These are things that happen. It's like red, probably a lot less so, but it's about, sure, it's illegal for you to wear purple, but you're dressing up in yellow, I'll tell you that much, you know? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, to me, when they do it like this, it just takes all of the style that these people had, because people had style. We may look at it and be like, it's garish, it's awful or whatever, but people from the 1890s would look at what we wear and say, you know, say it's garish and all, you know, like that's just mm-hmm. how style changes and everything. But when you do this and you make everyone like always wearing mud brown and everything like that, and there's no blue or there's no yellow or there's no anything like this, and there's no rich vegetables that are there that you could see them eating, or even like tasty looking meats or something like that, mm-hmm. it just robs them and it puts them into this little box. And to be fair, I mean, I don't think a lot of directors and people are comfortable actually wanting to portray peasants as more than just like dirt covered whatever, because that's convenient mm-hmm. for the story. But like with the Northmen, you could tell these people had their own style and interiority and lives, and mm. could tell they had this color, and you know, there was nice meat, and the slaves, even though they were enslaved, were still trying to have a life of some kind with someone that they loved or someone, you know, that they wanted to be with or whatever. And it's, and when you see that, it means a lot to me after doing the show with Eleanor, because you can do the mud caked peasant thing like in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yes.
Who died and made you king? You know, watery swords and thrown by water women, blah, blah, blah. You know, like you can do that. It could be very funny. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to do like a serious movie like this and you're just like, yep, they're all dirt stained, shit covered hill jacks with no teeth, and you're just like, well, you know, well,
thank okay. God for Robin Hood and the Lords,
yeah.
right?
The, yeah, there,
there's
right,
the
yeah.
hope the for something better.
98% of all the people who have lived before the modern era are like farmers or peasant yeah. level or whatever. And it's like, you know, fuck them. You know, the only people who had nice things were the rich. And the rich did have nicer things, much nicer things. But that's a separate critique, and it's not the... Mm.
And they're certainly not coming to fix it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
let's yeah. just put it yeah. that way, right?
Yeah, the 1938 Robin Hood has all the things you mentioned, Luke. It has tourneys, it has colors, mm-hmm. it has big mm-hmm. mutton legs.
Yes. If you're going to do yeah. historical anachronisms, have a fucking tourney and give them a turkey leg and have yes. them throw tomatoes at the knights. You know why?
Yeah.
Because when somebody looks at it and they're like, oh, well, actually, they didn't have tomatoes, you know, everyone's going to be like, yeah, but they threw them at the knights. It's fun, you know, like, yeah, they yeah. just...
Because you can say shut up nerd then. Yeah, you can yeah, say yeah, shut up nerd. Yeah. That's fine.
But yes. when you do right? it here, it's just like one historical inaccuracy adds on another and another and another. And you're like, what are we doing? Like,
and it's the claiming. Yeah, it's the claiming. It's the saying this is real. Mm-hmm. And then doing something completely unreal. Yeah, right. Definitely. That's the trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Along this line, I wanted to ask you guys, I feel like the medieval setting is one that is very popular for romanticization. We have like mm-hmm. the Western, we have classical mm-hmm. era, and like the medieval era. And there are so many stories set in this era. And I'm wondering, why do you think it is that people love the medieval era so much? Why it gets romanticized and like why it has a special place in fiction?
I think for us, it starts with the Victorians. Mm-hmm. And the Victorians really were quite obsessed with the medieval period, and they liked it as kind of a reaction largely to industrialization. Mm. And they were like, oh, it was a pure time and a clean time when everyone was out in the fields and there were still large extended families and you hadn't been chopped up into the smaller industrialized family unit and things were beautiful and there was a focus on God, mm. right? And so they start doing kind of like more medieval history, and also a lot of that is attached to ideas of nationalism that are coming up in the kind of like the 1890s and things like that. A lot of people start doing more medieval history specifically in order to give themselves a nationalized history. Mm-hmm. So people would oftentimes go back specifically to the medieval period and go, oh yeah, well, here's the thing about us that is really obvious about like why we are a group together. And then they wrote about stories and stuff. They love Robin Hood, mm-hmm. right? So they kind of kick off it being a part of our psyche, mm-hmm. I would say. And I think that it is now still like when we do these things, it is a reaction to the modern. It's a reaction to this kind of really atomized and separatized culture that we live in under capitalism, because, you know, we know that we are missing some things about the collectivity that existed under manorialism, and we kind of yearn mm-hmm. for that. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, sometimes we also then like to be like, and they were all covered in shit and it was mud. Actually, no, it's better now. shut up.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
So it allows us to do two things at the same time. It allows us to romanticize it and then go, oh, but actually isn't electricity nice?
Yeah, I feel like that schizophrenic nature is super well exemplified by Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, right? Mm-hmm. That narrator has so much contempt for the past in this very 19th century kind of way, but he's still romanticizing it, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think more speaking to the modern context of it, I honestly think the medievalism is a thing because Tolkien kind of brought it about. And
yeah, my man, yeah.
And became literally the sole basis for like an entire genre of writing, you know, fantasy, high fantasy, medieval fantasy, however you want to style it. He became that whole genre, and people just took it and went from there, and they started doing fantasy. And so you have your sword and shield fantasy, and then that leads into Dungeons and Dragons, which takes on these similar ideas, because you get this thing where you look back in the past, and when I do it, the further back in the past you go, the world gains a little bit more mystique, because we don't know as much about it. And theoretically, especially with ancient times and stuff, you could be like, well, you know, what was going on over here? We have no idea, because we have no records, and we know people were there, but maybe there was a dragon, maybe there was like a big vortex, you know, maybe there was Atlantis and it sank in, you know, into whatever. And that's a story that's been around since before the birth of Christ. But, you know, you get the idea. You have these things and you look at them, and it inspires this bit of magic in the world. And so when you get medievalisms and you get a high fantasy that Tolkien did, and now George R. R. Martin has picked up and taken in a slightly different direction, and that's what you get. And so we just kind of set all of these worlds there, because like the Middle Ages is when there were dragons, because Arthur stories have dragons. If you just ask a person for like a stereotypical context of what was the medieval times, it's like, that's when there were dragons and there were elves and there were woodland sprites. And, you know, everybody had these myths. The myths were still so strong. In the 1300s is when people are codifying in their own heads and through these weird permutations the King Arthur stories, the Arthuriana that we know, because there was stuff written back then and people were like, nah, fuck that. I don't like that story. That one doesn't count. And you get that, and then you get Tolkien, and Tolkien's like, my favorite things are Arthuriana, the Bible, and Beowulf. And hey, here you go.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah. Stir it all up, throw it against the wall, and it's stuck. And I think that's kind of why we're here. And all of this stuff is just downstream of that. And I mean, of course, as I said, like, it's changed and it's done differently. And you could do like a serious version and like a more kid-friendly version and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Tolkien and the English taking over the world, I would say, are probably.
Probably
has a lot to do with colonialism.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great transition to our closing thoughts.
Yeah.
So, closing thoughts. This movie, like I said at the top of the show, lost so much money that Hollywood kind of stopped making sword and sandals movies, right? Yeah. This movie lost $125 million. So the only people who got robbed in the Robin Hood movie were the studio.
Yeah.
And the British state, who wrote off £20 million in taxes to film this movie over there. So at least some rich Englishman got robbed, I guess. No, it's the taxpayer. Who am I kidding?
Yeah, last time we had to pay something like that, it was just to get Prince Andrew off of Nonsing. So, you know. I'll take this one, yeah.
Yeah, there are still sword and sandals, way fewer. But what we do have is what Luke was talking about. We do have some magic fantasy, right? We got more Lord of the Rings content. We get Game of Thrones. We get House of the Dragon. Because people did not like grounded, gritty, realistic, Ridley Scott-style sword and sandals. Give me dragons. And give me the Northmen.
Yes.
And give me fun anachronism.
Yeah, and I think the Northmen did that really, really well, of this, like, having the kind of magical realism in it. And it's something that I really enjoy when I see or read historical things. I read this really great book recently that I'm telling everyone that they should write. It's more like a novella called The Writing in the Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's set in Mesopotamia. Absolutely incredible. And it's got that like magical realism thing where it's like, well, this is how people thought about the world. So there's demons and stuff. So yeah, like Irving Finkel wrote it, who is one of the mad hardcore Mesopotamians. I think that is my number one jam, is it's like, and here's people who are doing the normal thing. I want to see like medieval people do a real medieval, like, I'm like, show me a girl making cheese and then a dragon shows up outside. What? You know, like, I want and then I want there to be like a griffin or something, right? Like, that's very fun for me. And also, I think that when I like fantasy things for that, because it lets me off the hook a little bit as a medievalist, where I'm like, well, I can relax now.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Because everyone isn't going to be like, hey, Eleanor, what is this? I'm like, no, bitch, it's not historically accurate. There's a dragon. All right. And then I can just have fun instead of like, you know, going like, that's not what Magna Carta means for an entire movie.
They were Normans. Right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to do it, if you're going to do like a realistic or grounded or what, or gritty or whatever, there are ways to do that. And the examples are stuff like A Song of Ice and Fire, Game of Thrones, stuff like that. Mm. And there are other authors out there, of course, or stuff like The Northmen, where it takes a realistic view of not only how peasants lived and how slavery was done and in this medieval kind of Viking esque society, but you also get some like magic thrown in there. But at the same time, yeah, the past is a foreign place and you can never understand that because you don't have an all encompassing abiding belief that when you die, you're going to go to Valhalla. People do not have the exact same belief in that is reinforced by society. We don't have that anymore, almost anywhere, probably anywhere in the world, but especially not in America and England and places like that. And the past is a foreign land like that. And so I think you can do it and you can do it well, but not where you just drain all the fun out of it. And as y'all said, you just do like Saving Private Robin and you're just like, great. Steven Spielberg already did this movie and it was really fucking good. Now he was doing it to like jerk off America about the Greatest Generation. But, you know, everyone else took from it. Holy shit, war is awful. This is horrifying. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. But at least he did it well, Ridley. What the fuck is this?
Like, the other thing is, also, if you want to make a medieval movie and you want to make Robin Hood Men in Tights or you want to make A Knight's Tale, yes, have fun.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. If you want a romp,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm like, yeah, have a great time. Like, I will never not watch Knight's Tale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, right? Yeah. You don't take anyone seriously who's like, it's anachronistic that they do the We Will Rock You clap
like,
chant.
Shut up, nerd.
No one cares.
Shut up, nerd.
Of course it is. Alan Tudyk is here doing the worst in and out Scottish accent I've ever heard in my life. Who gives a shit?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Heath Ledger's here not even trying to do a real English accent, just so you know, has that wide ass grin that everybody loves.
Such a good looking guy.
And it's like, yeah, no, there's a reason that nobody goes, oh, A Knight's Tale isn't very historically accurate, because it just leans into the anachronism to the point where you're just like, yeah, here's Paul Bettany doing American wrestling promos, you know, like he's like Mean Gene, you know, whatever, from like the old WCW days. He's like, and then we're gonna go down and I'm Chaucer and I'm gonna ride it. And he's doing like American style promos, and it's great.
Yeah.
And instead you get this dour bullshit.
I'm just mad at it because it is just intensely confusing that you can make an unfun Robin Hood movie.
Yes. Listen, you get the Robin Hood that your society deserves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my closing thought here, is that it's almost a psyop, but it's quite insidious in that the Robin Hood story changes over time based on what people want to inscribe into it. And so he's originally a yeoman. As the story gets told over the centuries, he sometimes becomes a noble. The whole thing about him supporting King Richard is something that comes later. Mm-hmm. And in 2010, might we have needed a cope for stealing from the rich and giving to the poor? Was that something that we might have needed back then? I don't know. I can't remember what happened in 2009. And it just was robbed from us, and instead we get this neoliberal Robin Hood. And so this movie is a stab in the back in almost every way.
Ridley Scott wants to make it clear that we don't need to go that far.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like maybe incremental, small changes here and there, maybe some new form of like oversight.
Yeah.
You know, there's some good rich people, such as himself, who could be trusted to help the poor.
Ridley Scott is here with the one critique that we've never heard ever, which is Occupy Wall Street. Maybe it did some things wrong. Ridley.
Thanks.
I had no idea. Wow. It wasn't like a era defining.
What about good rich people? Yeah. What about good rich people who, you know, like actually running 4,000 acres is really hard?
Yeah.
What about their stress levels?
But let's wrap it up.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a blast.
It was an honor, you know.
Rise, rise, rise. Something.
Yeah, so like I said at the top of the show, go check out We're Not So Different. They're great. And yeah, as I always say, like, subscribe, et cetera, et cetera.
And if you like the show, if you like Remember Shuffle and you want to support it in some way, I'll send you a watercolor in the mail and some stickers. If you tweet about it or post your Instagram story that you're liking the show, maybe with a screenshot of the podcast player app, just DM us so that I know you did it so I can send you the watercolor and the stickers as a thank you.
Anything else you'd like to plug specifically?
Oh, yeah. If you want a book about medieval history, I've got one out that is called The Once and Future Sex. It's an analysis of women's roles in the medieval period and now, and it's available wherever good books are sold. So, you know, it's fun if you want to know a little bit more about nerd shit.
Heck yeah.
And all right. I don't have any books. Y'all have fun. Enjoy, like, and subscribe to this podcast, and We're Not So Different. Thank you so much for having us on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Heck yeah. All right. Ciao, ciao.
Bye, everybody.
Ciao.
Bye.
Well, we folks of the animal kingdom have our own version. It's the story of what really happened in Sherwood Forest.
Let's talk a little bit about, and we didn't get a chance to record this with our guests, so you know, maybe we'll put this after the episode or something, but we had a couple more points here we didn't get to, namely the making of the movie. And I think we can talk about the making of the movie because it illustrates why the movie is like so unfocused, because someone wrote a script which was acquired by the studio in a seven-figure deal. It was called Nottingham, and it was about a sympathetic sheriff of Nottingham and a less virtuous Robin Hood in a love triangle with Maid Marian, which, I mean, this script ended up getting rewritten like seven times, and it's so funny that they paid like seven figures for the original script because it's free IP. Like, you're looking for a recognizable IP, and they chose like a folk tale. And
wait, Jordan, you're telling me we got Robin Hood for only $1 million?
Yep, and it ended up getting rewritten into a story about the Sheriff of Nottingham, who's a CSI-style forensic investigator who's looking for Robin Hood, and he's torn about what to do about the crimes. Should he join Robin Hood or tacitly support him in some way or capture him?
You are describing the plot to the Boondock Saints.
Yeah, so this sounds an awful lot like the plot to the medieval Boondock Saints, which honestly, I kind of wish that was the movie that got made.
Yes, the Sheriff of Nottingham firing a crossbow in the air, you know, drenched in sweat, just in frustration, shouting, "There was a mummer's farce!"
Yeah, I mean, at least he could still say, like, the Latin prayer before executing people. You know, the Spiritus
Sanctus. Wouldn't confuse anyone, though. They would just know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would love if the Sheriff of Nottingham was talking about the crimes with the local PD, you know, and was like, "This is South Nottingham. I'm surprised you even got a phone call."
It couldn't be phone call.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. "This is South Nottingham. I'm surprised you even got a raven."
Yeah, South Nottingham. You really hit that Boston accent hard on it.
South Nottingham. You know, it's a 100% Mercian neighborhood. "I'm surprised you even got a raven."
It's Rocco's joke that he tells under duress.
Yes.
But it's like, you know, a Norman, a Welshman, and a Saxon find a genie. Saxon says, "So you're telling me all the Normans and all the Welshmen are gone?" Genie says, "Yeah." He says, "All right, then I'll have a mead."
Yeah, "I'll have a chicory water."
"I'll have a chicory water." Chicory?
Chicory water. "I'll have a chicory water.
I'll have a chicory water."
Mm-hmm.
It's so fucking stupid.
Yeah, and then like the script gets rewritten, and the plot is that Robin Hood becomes the Sheriff of Nottingham and then is forced to go back into being Robin Hood. And I'm glad that this is the version of the movie we kind of ended up getting, where he becomes a nobleman. He has to change the system from the inside.
Yeah.
That's how real political change is done. Oh, fuck, I did want to ask them this question, but like, just maybe I'll save it for next time. But like, the Writers Guild is currently on strike.
Mm.
And I've just always thought it was funny that, like, we still have guilds for certain industries, mm-hmm. you know, like that's like a medieval remnant for like certain industries. Like, I love the idea of Donald Trump being like, I don't like unions. Not a big fan of unions. I like guilds. Guilds I like.
Guilds were classy. Yes. They don't make them like guilds anymore.
Uh-huh. I'm a big guild guy. I support organized labor. I support tons of organized labor. He says I don't, but that's not true. I support the Cobbler's Guild.
I love the Hooper Guild.
I love the Cooper Guild. I love the Coopers. Don't ever say I don't like the Coopers.
What are other archaic jobs? The lamplighters. We love our lamplighters, don't we, folks?
I'll never attack the Lamplighters Guild. That I can tell you.
All right. Ciao, ciao.
Bye, everybody.